On April 26, 2006, Dr. Ricky Ott of Cordova, Alaska, an expert on the impacts of the Exxon Valdez tanker disaster, spoke to an audience at the Vancouver Public Library. Dr. Ott's speech was sponsored by a coalition of environmental groups opposing offshore oil and gas development and tanker traffic through the pristine coastal waters of British Columbia. Drawing from her book, Sound, Truth, and Corporate Myths, The Legacy of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill, Dr. Ott addressed the ecological, social, and economic aftermath of the Exxon catastrophe, the consequences of which are still being felt 17 years after the accident. Dr. Ott's knowledge and experience provides valuable insights for citizens around the world concerned about the impacts of oil transport and offshore drilling on marine and human communities. The Living Ocean Society, the Georgia Strait Alliance, the David Suzuki Foundation, and the other members of the BC Coalition hope the lessons learned in Alaska can help to prevent similar disasters in our oceans. Dr. Ott.
So this begins our talk tonight, and what I want to share with you is what we've learned from this and what the lessons, perhaps, that maybe you can apply to your situation here. To refresh everybody's memory of this incident, the star here represents Prince William Sound. Cordova is where I live 21 years now. And the orange line to the north is the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. That's the 800-mile delivery system from the North Slope fields on down to Prince William Sound, where then the tankers, most of them, take the oil south out of Prince William Sound. Exxon Valdez ended her journey prematurely, and after 3 days of perfectly calm weather, with minimal oil spill containment equipment being launched, a storm sprang up and swept the oil out of Prince William Sound to points as far distant as 1,200 miles from the point of impact, oiling about 3,200 miles of coastline in between. I will say that immediately, within 24 hours, two versions of what was going on occurred. Exxon's version maintained that it spilled 11 million gallons and that there were 1,200, 1,300 miles of beach oiled. The government's version, which surfaced 4 years later due to my persistent phone calls, it turns out there was a little investigation the government did, and the government found that really what spilled was closer to 30 to 35 million gallons, and none of this straight as the crow flies, but all the bays and little crenulations in between. And if you added all that up, it was closer to 3,200 miles. This is now public information at the public library in Anchorage, these documents. What I call the legacy of the Exxon Valdez really starts on the beaches of Prince William Sound. This is where about 45% of the oil grounded, stayed, became buried under the seaweeds and kelp, and unfortunately a lot of it still remains to this day, 100 tons conservatively estimated by the federal scientists. So here's where the legacy begins. I'm going to be talking about three main topics tonight. One is people and oil. So worker health, public health, and oil. What do we really now know? Secondly, environmental health, oil and the environment. Again, what have we learned post-Exxon Valdez? And finally, because of these two changes in our understanding, what does this mean now for social ramifications? What does this legacy have for us now, today, relevant to our issues? So let's have a look at the people first. Now, the workers in Prince William Sound, Exxon hired an army of people. It was 11,000 people at the peak. There were people coming, there were people going. So I don't have an exact count. But the point is that people used, primarily the workers on the beaches, used a high-pressure hot water wash. I'm sure those of you who saw the images on television, remember all these spraying going on. And unfortunately, that did two things. One was, okay, think about this. High pressure, hot water, hot water. If you hit a beach with hot water, what are you going to do to the mussels, the clams that survived the initial oiling? I mean, when you want to eat mussels, what do you do to them? You steam them in hot water, right? And essentially what this treatment did was it strafed the beaches and wiped bare anything that had survived the initial oiling. So that was number one. Number two, pressure. The pressurized part of this, and these were literally firemen's hoses. And what happened was the seawater hit the oiled rocks with such force that it bounced the oil into the air and people breathed it. So it turned out it was not just any old oil. It was a very toxic fraction of oil called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs. The significance being that in the 1970s, when the oil science first developed, people thought, oh, the concentration, people focused, the scientists focused on just one ring there. One ring is benzene, all right? It dissolves quickly into the water, it evaporates quickly into the air. Those compounds, the volatile organic carbons, the water-soluble fraction, those became the focus of the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the science at the time. So somehow, over time, people forgot that it was only that little fraction of oil. And really what we found out in Prince William Sound, it's the black stuff that's left on the beaches that doesn't go into the air very quickly, that doesn't go into the water very quickly. That's the problem. And so that became the focus of 6 years of research, which I put into my book and also the subject of this talk. So now, one of the things that happened was I got a lot of phone calls from people, and I'm still getting those phone calls to this day. There are people from all across the United States, from Hawaii to Florida, California, New York. They all sounded like Darth Vader on the phone. They had trouble breathing. And these people say, I worked the Exxon Valdez cleanup. I got sick then. I thought I would get better, but I haven't. Do you think that this problem could be related to the cleanup? So I started digging in the court records. There were a handful of workers, two dozen or so workers, who filed toxic tort cases. In other words, they were so sick and they felt so sure it was from the cleanup work that they sued Exxon for health effects. In digging through those court records, I uncovered Exxon's own data showing that in 1989 alone, there was a total of 6,722 workers that reported respiratory problems. This was about two of every three people who actually worked on the beaches with those fire hoses. Exxon never reported this further up the chain to the federal and state health officials. Instead, Exxon claimed it was cold or flu, so it was not work-related, because you can get a cold or flu anywhere. And so Exxon never reported this. When I uncovered it in the court records, Exxon had the data sealed from the public so that other people now cannot go to these same court records. However, I got the data before they were sealed, and they're published in my book. This is figure two in my book showing Exxon's own data. So PAHs seemed to be extraordinarily bad for people. The other thing that happened on the cleanup was that Exxon experimented with its cleanup products. And any oil company will do this. They are allowed to field test their chemical cleanup products. Lab tests. They can only test them in the lab. So the first time they actually get to see if they work for real is when there's an oil spill. So basically, it's a giant experiment. And the words that we came to know were things like dispersants. Dispersants are designed to be used on the ocean surface where there's a huge body of water underneath. And literally, you spray these things onto the water surface, and they disperse or break up the oil. Then the wave action mixes the oil and the toxic dispersant with the big volume of water, and the solution to pollution is dilution, so it breaks up the oil. The other word is bioremediation, which is a fertilizer product, or it's marketed as a fertilizer product. It's marketed as you spray this on the beaches and it will enhance the growth of bacteria, which occur naturally. The bacteria will then eat the oil. What the oil industry did not say, but which has to be listed on the material safety data sheet for any of these products, is that these products also contain industrial solvents designed to basically dissolve oil. These industrial solvents are, at least in America, listed by OSHA, our Occupational Safety and Health Administration, as human health hazards. All right? These actually, some of these products, not all of them, but some of them, come with warnings, toxic to wildlife and fish. Do not get in water courses. Prevent from entering water courses or low areas. Despite all these warnings, hundreds of thousands of liters of these chemicals were put on our beaches. And by the way, the industrial solvents, if they're designed to dissolve oil and grease, what do you think they do to plastic rain gear? Right. So these people got pretty sick. And as soon as Exxon discovered that people were getting sick, Exxon, I found this in the court records also, it's figure one in my book, Exxon paid people $600.50 to sign a release waiving Exxon of any future health claims filed by the cleanup workers. So the point here is, while Exxon was in public saying safety is our number one priority, this is what they were doing, and also labeling these respiratory problems as colds and flu. If it's colds and flu, you get over it, right? I had one person tell me, I thought I had the Valdez crud in 1989. I didn't think I'd have it for 12 years. I mean, that's what I've been hearing. Now, because I was hearing this from the cleanup workers, I thought, well, cleanup workers are really, or any chemical workers really, are exposed, potentially exposed to high levels of the chemicals that they work with. So if they get sick, then these workers tend to be like a canary in the coal mine. And for the rest of the public, maybe at low levels, these same chemicals aren't so good for the public health either. So I started talking to medical doctors and saying, oh, okay, we've got the cleanup workers here, Exxon Valdez, you know, they're calling me, they're sick. What are you saying? Well, the Gulf War vets have the same problem from the burning oil field wells. And oh yes, we have linked PAHs found in traffic exhaust. These are at levels below which the government thinks is safe. Okay, so the bar is here. These are levels that are supposed to be safe. We have linked these levels with things like asthma, depression, and chemical sensitivities. Linked them. So in other words, PAHs are also causing public health problems, but kind of under a radar screen right now. In the States, I don't know if it's true here, the number one chronic illness in our children under 18 is asthma. And I'm not saying it's all because of PAHs, but I'm saying that it's time for we, the people, to start connecting the dots with these illnesses, with potential causation. Okay. Now, there was enough accumulated evidence by 1999 for the United States Environmental Protection Agency to list 22 of the PAHs found in crude oil on its list of, this is officially called the Persistent Bioaccumulative Toxic Pollutant List, all right? But really what this list is, it's a list of the most deadly compounds acknowledged to cause environmental problems to people and the environment. This list is very short. It includes dioxin, lead, mercury, PCBs, DDT, and now compounds in oil. And I would like to point out that with the exception of PAHs, none of these other compounds do we put in the gas tanks of our automobiles. We used to put in lead, and after I think it was a 65-year battle between the oil industry, the car industry, and the public health, we finally took lead out. And I also, I guess, want to quickly point out that on this list, persistent means these chemicals stay in the environment for a long time, and they're very mobile. They bioaccumulate, they move between organisms, they get transferred up the food web. And toxic here on this list is toxic in the sense not of dead bodies, okay, but toxic in the sense of causing cellular damage that reduces an individual's fitness or health. So reproductive problems, immune suppression, well, cancers, that's an obvious one, genetic problems. It's a more subtle toxic, but it'll get you anyway, right? All right, that's people for now. All right, we're going to get back to people later. But what I want to do is paint a little mirror for you here, because when I started discovering, I was actually shocked that PAHs were this toxic and people didn't know about this. When I talked to the doctors, they said, what are you finding with the wildlife? And I said, well, we're finding, that's my area of expertise. I know that. I can answer that. And they said, you know, when you have sick people and you have sick animals and you have the sickness is caused from the same chemical, that's the strongest evidence you have that that chemical is a problem. So the way I frame this in the book Sound Truth and Corporate Myths is the way I'm presenting it to you now. Sick people, sick animals, we have a problem, okay? So with the sick animals, I start with this slide because in 1989, Prince William Sound, we were inundated with scientists, lawyers, I mean, you name it. But the fishermen went to a lot of the scientists and said, what is going to happen to us? We need to make a living. We need to support our families. Is Prince William Sound ruined forever? Should we just sell out and go somewhere else? And the scientists said, oh, no. It should be okay. Oil only has its short-term effects. They weren't lying. This was the state of understanding at the time based on the 1970s science. So the fishermen said, okay, we'll stay. So 89, 90, 91, 92, we had the first pink salmon run collapse. Pink salmon are two-year fish. Fish, two-year cycle fish, so there's a completely different genetic stock, odd year, even year. Fishermen said, okay, we can handle one bad year, let's wait till the next year. 93, the pink salmon collapsed again, and also in 93, the herring collapsed. Fishermen said, that's it. This looks like long-term damage to us. It looks like all the young of the year from 89 can't reproduce or are having other problems, and we're just seeing it now. So it looks to us like there's long-term problems. We couldn't get anybody's attention, so what we did was we took our seine boats and we blockaded Valdez Narrows. Valdez Narrows is the geologic bottleneck, and we held up tanker traffic for 3 days. This was a big deal. This was a big deal. And as a result of this, what we demanded was that scientists please get their act together and tell us what's wrong with Prince William Sound. We just want to know when it's going to get better. And Clinton had been elected in 92, so 93 he was just taking office, and we got funding. Not we, the fishermen, but the scientists. This political pressure generated the funding for the scientists to answer our question. So first I'm going to show you how this shift occurred in scientific understanding from the 1970s to now, the 1990s, 2000s. We're talking about 35 years here, roughly. And basically in the 1970s, 1980s, when I was going through college and doing my doctoral work, literally I was in the lab doing these tests called bioassays. And the way it looked, science was done back then, was that predominantly these were lab studies, mostly with a single species put into these beakers. The beakers had different concentrations of the water-soluble fraction. This is the single benzene ring molecule. So that was a sort of the surrogate for oil, just this fraction. And then, you know, as a result of these four-day tests, you kind of conclude that, oh, oil is toxic at parts per million. That was the thinking from the 1970s on. All right, then, after the blockade, starting in 1994, there was about 8 years of ecosystem studies. There were four different studies. And the difference was that these studies were conducted primarily in the field. The scientists went into the field and they said, this is what we're observing. Can we go back to the lab and try to mimic what's happening to try to explain what we're seeing in the field? So it was a reversal of sort of reality perspective. Instead of just being in the lab and saying, oh, we think we can extrapolate to the field, we're actually in the field saying, oh, this is what we're seeing. Now, can we explain this? Can we use the lab to explain this? And significantly, the scientists looked at multiple species over multiple generations. So these studies were conducted over several years running. So none of this four-day stuff. You actually got to determine if you could see if there were long-term effects. The focus shifted to the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, the PAHs. And finally, as a result of these studies, the scientists have now concluded that oil is toxic. Toxic at parts per billion. That's 1,000 times more toxic than we thought. This is 1 to 20 parts per billion. This is like if you see a puddle with a rainbow sheen in it, that's parts per billion. That's enough to kill. Well, I'll get into what it's enough to do here, to kill wildlife. So let's go through some species here. With sea otters, we're still seeing an effect. At least we were in 2004 when kind of the bulk of the studies finished. The problem here is that these young animals, the weanlings, the ones that first wean from their parent, they're small, they have small lungs, they have to go shallow to feed, and shallow is where the beaches are still oiled. So the little guys are digging down and getting into these pits, these reservoirs of buried oil, and eating oil-contaminated shellfish, and it's still high enough to actually kill them. We have areas that were heavily oiled that are simply not recovered at all. Harlequin ducks, sort of a similar story. I want to say here that there was some pioneering science that was done in Prince William Sound that's now routinely done. One of the because the wildlife biologists looked at what the medical doctors were doing. the medical doctors were drawing blood samples and experimenting with forensic chemistry. Can we track in the blood? Can we track chemical exposure? And they found yes, they could, the medical doctors. And they had biomarkers indicating PAH exposure. And so the wildlife biologist said, can we adapt those techniques for wildlife, for whales, for birds, for fish? And with a lot of experimenting, they found they could. So using this sort of sub-skin detective work, what they found with harlequin ducks was that the ducks in the winter are still dying in greater numbers on the beaches that were once heavily oiled. What the scientists found was that when the ducks, I want to say here that in December and January, this is when these deaths are occurring, that is when there's the least amount of light in Prince William Sound. These ducks need light in order to feed their visual feeders. So there's just enough daylight in Prince William Sound in the winter where they can eat enough to survive to the next daylight. However, if they run into toxic chemicals, their bodies start producing an enzyme to break down these toxic chemicals. And the production of those enzymes is an energetic cost. That cost takes away from the energy needed to survive. So it's literally robbing Peter to pay Paul kind of a thing. And that's by February, there's more daylight. And so the ducks can eat more. They have more calories. They can do both. They can break down toxic chemicals and they can survive. It's pretty subtle, but it's still happening 17 years later. River otters started recovering after about 8 years, but their story, again, was found in the blood. And what happened with them was that the river otters in Prince William Sound live in the coastal forest, rainforest. They feed in the ocean. They feed mostly on really fast-swimming fish. And the scientists' first clue that something was wrong was when they noticed that the otters in oiled areas were eating things that held still. They had completely switched their diet around. So they were eating octopus and starfish and very slow swimming fish. And it was like, they're starving. What is going on? So the scientists captured some, took them to the lab, gave them oil, ingested, and measured. They measured that this oil messed up, interfered with the synthesis of heme, which is an essential component of hemoglobin, and which basically wiped out oxygen transport. So here these river otters, they looked healthy. They would take a big gulp of air to chase a fish, and they had the oxygen wasn't getting distributed to their muscles, so they had to give it up. So again, this was about 8 years or so, and then we started to see the river otters recover. Pink salmon. What the scientists were able to determine, again, using the lab studies to match what they were seeing in the field, and what they were seeing in the field was increased egg mortality every year after the spill from 1989 through 1992-93. Instead of, the oil would hit the beach and then, that would be the most toxic hit right away, right? That's what you sort of intuitively think, and then it would get better over time. It got worse over time. The scientists were like, what is going on? And I have to explain that pink salmon, you probably have this idea of salmon going up river systems to spawn. In Prince William Sound, because of the 1964 earthquake, the land was sort of heaved up really quickly, and the pink salmon had to improvise. They couldn't make the leap, so they just started spawning on the beaches, and of course the beaches were what was oiled, right? So what the scientists documented in the lab was that when pink salmon eggs are exposed to very low levels of PAHs, the PAHs transfer out of the water and are selectively absorbed by the fatty tissue, by the lipids. So on the beaches, here are these little nests, pink salmon reds, and the tide comes in, and the tide picks up oil from across the whole beach and just flushes, bays these pink salmon beds. As it drains out on the ebb, it goes to the lowest point. The lowest point are these nests that are dug down, so it just drains across these eggs, and PAH is transferred out into the eggs. And so it killed the eggs for about 92, 93, 3, 4 years. The other thing that the scientists were able to measure was that the oil actually interfered with the growth of the juvenile, the fry and the juvenile salmon. You would never see a fish like in the lower slide here with deformed skeleton. Ascites, it can't metabolize water properly, so it's got that swollen belly, because that would have obviously died and disappeared in the wild in the lab that could catch this and show what was happening, top fish is a control fish. The scientists also measured the oil sheen on the surface in these bays was indicative of sort of a cloud of PAHs in the water column. So when the young pink salmon fry popped out of this nest into the nursery bays, they were still exposed to high levels of PAHs, which the scientists documented in the water column. And again, it's stunted growth. It's stunted growth because the young fish took in the PAHs, their bodies started manufacturing these enzymes to break down the toxic threat, and that robbed energy from growth. And this was observed in more things than fish, too, this stunted growth. Black oyster catchers, for one. Now, the herring were a little bit different because herring have a different life cycle. They mature when they're, the bulk of them mature when they're 4 years old. So the significance of the crash in 93, I mean, if you subtract 4 years, 1989, right? So what happened was the young of the year from 1989 didn't make it, basically. And the ones that did make it, the scientists were later able to document that exposure of herring eggs and embryos to very low levels of oil, parts per billion, parts per trillion, mess up the immune system of these young fish. So that when they become adults, they're less able to ward off diseases and viruses that are carried in the normal population. It's like in people with a common cold. I mean, it's always out there. But as long as your resistance is strong, you're not going to get a cold, right? But if you're, you know, in a major spawning frenzy with tons of other salmon, herring, that's when the disease outbreak happened. And it has since occurred. We have had repeated disease outbreaks in Prince William Sound to the point where now herring are in a what the scientists call a predator pit, where the young of the year that get reproduced every year are needed by the rest of the ecosystem, all the other wildlife to survive. So the herring can't generate extra herring. There's no fishery, for example. We have not fished herring. We fished it twice since 93. I mean, the herring fishery is closed down for all indefinitely, according to Fish and Game. Now, this has also had an effect on the ecosystem because herring are the cornerstone species of Prince William Sound. There's over 40 species, birds, fish, and mammals, that feed on herring. And, for example, black-legged kittiwakes were fine in 1989. They did not get harmed by the oil spill because they're visual feeders. They have to plunge into a school of herring. They have to be able to see it from the air. And if the oil spill was covering the surface, they just went to a clean bay to look for herring. So they were fine. They were fine until 1993 when the herring runs collapsed and there were no young of the year herring to feed their fledglings, their young chicks. So the pigeon guillemots are having problems. There are other species as well that are having problems. And I want to say here that Exxon does not acknowledge that there's these types of indirect effects. Exxon's just looking what was got listed in 89 as being affected.
That ends part one of two. You can order Dr. Ricky Ott's book, Sound Truth and Corporate Myths, from any online bookseller, including Amazon.com. You can go to our website at soundtruth.info. And for more information on this issue, go to oilfreecoast.org or livingoceans.org. This lecture was recorded by Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. And you can find a full copy of the lecture for listening or download at that site.